To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. All right, you heard the song. You know who we are. I'm Don Moore, and with me is...
My name is Scott Connor.
Scott Connor's been a listener. I turned up in his town. We just had dinner. I thought, well, we haven't been able to put a show out for a while, so I thought I'd get Scott on. Scott's one of the most interesting people I ever met. And one thing that... Nobody thinks they're interesting.
You met, two people then?
Yeah. Okay. But one thing I found about Scott was just talking online. This guy is a conversationalist, and he drove up, met me at the hotel, and when I came down, he's talking to the person at the counter, and you act like you've known each other all your life.
Sometimes.
It depends on the
person.
I'm the opposite. If I don't know somebody, I just stay quiet, you know. But I noticed that the whole time I've been here, you're just jawing with anybody, and it's always an interesting conversation.
I'd actually talked to her earlier when we got here. We talked about some different subjects and things like
that.
Yeah.
That's an art a lot of us don't have.
Fair enough. I think I probably got that from my grandfather. I don't think he ever met anybody he never knew.
Rare trait for some people.
There you go.
Anyway, Scott's a comic book guy, heavy metal guy. You're actually pretty rounded. We just had dinner, and we were talking about
especially
history.
The metal after having dinner. Yeah, more
yeah
rounded
well,
than like
all
to
of
be.
Us. Anyway, one thing I want to start out on, Scott was always telling me about the goon, which isn't something that, it's one of those things I've seen on comic shops, I've seen on the wall.
Right.
I like Eric Powell's artwork, and every time I say this, people kind of roll their eyes, but I always got the goon, the Max, the Pit, and Lobo confused. You know, big guys with four-letter names, I guess that's it. But
I think the goon came a little bit later than any of those guys actually did. They were a little earlier on.
Yeah. Now, how did you find, when did you start reading this?
Oh, gosh. That's a really good question. I think it had been recommended to me by a friend of mine, and then I read, you know, like you'll do your homework on something. You'll read articles. You read interviews with the creators.
Yeah.
They talk about different things, and you know, it's like, okay, this sounds pretty good, so go and read it. And I read, you know, a few scattered issues here and there, and I had an idea of what the characters were like and what the story arcs were like to some degree. So I was familiar with it, but then I got the first two omnibus editions, which are like the nice collected, like the Hellboy Library, for example.
Yes.
Things are amazing.
Yes.
There are pages in there that are literally laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I caught myself several times just, like, laughing out loud and nobody else was in the house, you know. it's really good stuff. You can really tell he had a background where he probably grew up on things like Jack Davis, Looney Tunes. Sometimes you can see influences in both his art and his storytelling, how he puts pages together and how he sequences things. But it's not, even though you can see influences, it's his own work.
Right.
Yeah, so it's never...
When I see Eric Powell's work, and when I say this, I'm not familiar with it. I'm a superficial observer. When you've told me about it, I want to go read it. And I've looked him up online. I see what you mean about Jack Davis. When I think of Jack Davis, I think of really loose and sketchy. Whereas I see Eric Powell's, he's got a smooth rendering to it.
Right.
And to me... I've seen other artists kind of work that way, but it's unique to him. He's got a look that I've never seen anybody else do.
He's got a couple different styles sometimes where on purpose he'll tell the traditional Eric Powell story in an art style that you're used to.
Right.
But then every once in a while he'll throw in something a little bit different, a little bit different atmosphere or like sepia tones, things like that to get a certain mood going. So some artists do that, but a lot of artists don't. It's kind of cool to see that he can mix things up a little bit.
Well, what is the goon? Can you tell us a little bit about that, exactly what it is?
How much do you want me to tell you without ruining the story?
Well, don't ruin the story, but I mean, when I see it, what I see is a big guy with like a taxi cab hat.
Yes.
And he's always fighting something, and he doesn't quite look all human to me, and I never could tell.
He is all human, but he's probably designed to look like a stereotypical. I don't know if this really does it justice or not, but the closest equivalent I can think of in another comic book would be almost like Marv from Sin City.
Oh, okay.
Big guy, craggy.
Right.
Facial features. Basically a thug.
That's a good example.
Yeah. With a good heart.
Right. Yeah. But when I see it, it looks like 1920s Oklahoma or something. I see old vehicles.
Yeah, I could definitely see where you get a 20s, 30s kind of vibe from certain parts of it, yeah.
And why is he always fighting?
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but when he was a kid, he grew up in a circus.
Okay.
You know, circus carnies, things like that. So, you know, growing up as a kid, probably in stories that would seem in place in like 20s, 30s Depression era, you got to be tough and you got to take care of yourself. There's some things that happened to him as a kid that I don't want to ruin for other people.
Exactly.
That kind of led him down that path.
I got you. Nice stuff. No, Scott's always told me about it. It's one of those things, and the other guys in the show, we've talked about it, and I've asked. It, like me, they've seen it, they know of it, they know Eric Powell. I was asking Scott earlier what else Eric Powell did, because I know his name, yet I've never read anything that I know of.
Well, he's got a newer series that's called Hillbilly, which is excellent. It's like one of the best comics I've read in a long time. It's the thing that has impressed me the most in the past 5 years, other than maybe Atomic Robo.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that good.
That's a great series.
From what I gather, and I may be barking up the wrong tree a little bit, but the main influence I can see on him doing Hillbilly, which is tales set in the Appalachians, is probably Manly Wade Wellman, who was an author. I can't remember the name of his protagonist. I think it was Silver String Jack. But he would go around through the Appalachians and have different adventures, and a lot of them would have a supernatural element to them. But the Hillbilly stuff is fantastic. The writing.
Yeah.
It's just the combination of the writing and the pacing, how he puts his pages together, how they flow sequentially. It's really impressive.
It's something, one of my favorite things. I like teams. But my favorite is artist writers. If they can do their own work and they can, it's just, to me, it's second to none.
I agree.
But sometimes I've seen artists that start writing their own stories and they lose a little bit of poetry, they lose a little bit of depth.
Sometimes,
you know what I mean?
It depends on the person.
But if you've got,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, if you've got one that can write and draw and it's just, that's absolutely my favorite.
Jeff Smith's another good example.
Yeah,
of that.
Jeff
Smith. He can write and draw all day long.
Have you ever read his work, Razzle?
I've read parts of it. I actually have the hardcover, but I haven't read the entire thing yet. I like the concept of the story.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. It's like I've, you know, like a bathroom kind of read. Like I've read so far, but like one of these days I'm going to get around to reading the rest of it as well.
We've talked about the show. Most all of us have read Bone. You know, it was one of those, it was a neat series, and I'd heard of Razzle. I've heard other podcasts talk about Razzle.
Right.
And Dallas had talked about it. I remember I bought the third issue. And, you know, they're really big.
That's one of the things I liked about it. A lot of people don't like books that are dimensioned differently than your traditional pamphlet.
Exactly.
I love oversized books.
You and I talk. Scott is he's a big fan, which I like them, but I'm too cheap. It was those artist editions.
Yes.
When we talk online, you're about to swoon, like you're swooning over Elvis Presley.
I can't afford all the ones I want, but there's a specific few that, like when the Mark Schultz and his Ark Tales came out, and I've got to have it.
Yeah.
I have to, it's like my holy grail. I have to have it. And I bought it.
Well, my daughter sees those in the stores and she has a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And all I think was, they're great, but where am I going to put it? And I've asked you, and you've told me about places, what you do for it.
Put it on top of your bookshelf, flat, you know, lay it down like a newspaper.
Yeah.
Stack them on top of each other.
If you like
the books, you'll find room.
Well, I've got some large books and I find places, but it's just kind of, you know, odd. But some things deserve the larger format. I got the third issue of Bone. Razzle, and I got the first copy, but I didn't want to read them until I got them all together.
Right.
I ended up, I read them online. It was a great series. Reading it, I just read it on an iPad Mini, and I really enjoyed it. Dallas and I talked about the show, and it was one of those books where, as great as it was, and the artwork was really, really good, I didn't see why that really needed to be an oversized format. I mean, I didn't mind it being an oversized. When I read a small Mobius the Inkle, that's my absolute favorite right. story. Well, when they publish it smaller, it loses
it
something.
It does, yeah, it does not have the same effect. Or
and that one, I knew that they put out a hardcover that was oversized. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have bought it.
It's
didn't.
Still available.
No, the oversized, I thought the oversized sold out.
Oh,
right
you're
away.
Talking about like the really expensive?
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, I've got the regular one.
$50
yeah.
version?
Yeah. Yeah. But that one, I hate to say it, that's one I'd be tempted to, you know.
It's always the one that got away that you would shoot.
But I've always had a European size, but Humanoids mm-hmm. put it out, and it's a little bit smaller. And to me...
Yeah, I think Charles Vest really turned me on. Like, he's got a large library in his studio, and he's got some of the, what are called the European album format,
yeah,
oversized
yeah.
hardcovers. I love those things. They're great.
But that you know? That's one where you want to see the artwork a little larger sometimes.
Right. But yeah, I see what you mean. Some artists are going to benefit more right. from that
well,
than others.
You mentioned
others.
Charles Vest. He's mm-hmm. another one I like to see his work larger.
Yeah.
And I want to say that it doesn't... Jeff Smith is a great artist. Uh-huh. When I saw it oversized, it looked nice. But when you shrink it down, it didn't lose anything to me. It looked fine.
Well, that's good design.
Yeah. That's his thing. And Razzle, the story, I wasn't expecting any of that. Every time I read that, wait a minute, what? And it kept me... The guy is a great artist, but he's equally as good of a writer, and that's a rare thing.
I think a lot of people were wondering, like, after you do something as good as Bone is, like, what the hell do you do next after that? That's going to...
He did another series.
It's like when Bernie Wrightson did Frankenstein. What the hell are you going to do after that that's going to live up to that for the rest of your career?
Right.
You
know? God, that's absolutely my favorite thing he did.
It's like when your magnum opus comes early in your career, you're kind of stuck.
Jeff Smith, I was in the comic store, and there was a book called Tiki. It was a four-issue series.
Yeah,
about
I never
Caveman.
Read any of those. Yeah.
I just went to
forgot comic. About it until you just brought it up.
Yeah, I found it in the comic shop, 2 issues, and I ordered the other 2 issues. It's great, and it's in color. And he works good in color, even though mostly it's black and white.
Right.
And I only know that, and then he did Razzle.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've liked everything he's done. They're quite nice. But how did we got on this? We started talking about Jeff Smith. What were we talking about before that?
Oversized books, I think.
Oversized books. You're like being with Al.
We went off on a tangent that just went
Well,
way
tangents
way
are good.
Bizarre.
But, what did I say? Now I've lost myself here.
Sorry.
Just keep going with the stuff. We were talking about the Hellboy collections.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
They're great.
The Hellboy work. Yeah. Have you read any other besides the Mike Mignola work?
Mike Mignola's work other than Hellboy? Yes.
Yeah, the Mignola work.
Matter of fact, one of my favorite books that I've ever read is a one-shot that he did called The Amazing Screw-On Head.
Yeah.
That book is perfect. It is a perfect example of a one-shot story that works well on its own.
Right.
The timing of some of the dialogue is just sheer genius.
That's the Gary Gianni work, right?
No. This was done by Mike himself. He did the artwork.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I never saw that.
Yeah, it's not part of the Hellboy universe. It's a standalone story.
Right.
There was actually an animated, I can't remember if it was 30 minutes or an hour long, show that was really good, and it was done in that art style, and it worked well.
Yeah.
But they had plans of doing other episodes, but I think if you do that, it's like there's a perfect story, and why go back to it again and ruin it?
Exactly.
You know, and even Mike has said that. He wants to do some other work, from what I understand, in that same similar vein.
Right.
But I think even he has had reservations about going back to The Amazing Screw-On Head because it's just perfect as it is.
Yeah, and what a great title. I love that.
It's really good. Yeah, but what else he's done? I mean, he's done a lot of writing over the past few years. I mean,
that's his
whole
main thing.
Lobster Johnson, love that stuff. Because basically it's a love letter to action here.
Right.
Pulp heroes of the 30s.
That stuff was appearing when he was doing Hellboy. He started having backup stories, and that's where Lobster Johnson popped in.
Mm-hmm.
He started doing some BPRD stuff.
Yes.
And
getting back to Gary Gianni, that was probably, I think, the first backup story that was in Hellboy that was called Monster Man.
Yeah.
And Gary Gianni did that.
And you're a huge fan of his.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I've seen it. It's good work. Yeah. And then I know he did Prince Valiant, the newspaper strip, for quite a while, which, again, you loved. I see his work all the time now. Because of you, I joined the Gary Gianni Facebook group.
Exactly. That's the newest Hellboy project that came out, which I can't remember the exact title of. But Gary Gianni drew that. And, of course, Mike Mignola drew it. And those two guys together are just... on a different plane.
You know, that's what surprises me on that work. When I was surprised when I started seeing other people draw Hellboy. You know,
cause some people can do that well and others don't.
Well, I agree. Yeah. And I would think it would fall flat on their face because Mike Mignola, he's very unique. I mean, when you see it, it's you know it's Mike Mignola.
Yep.
He works in a simple style that he can pull off, but some people may not. But some of those books I've seen people have brought in and shown me, some of them, even though they're completely different artists, they still have a feel for what Mike Mignola was doing.
Right.
And what amazes me is, I'll be honest with you, if Mike Mignola didn't draw it, I normally don't read them unless somebody shows it to me. Which, shame on me, because some of the stuff I've seen and some of the stuff you told me.
There is some Hellboy stuff that is definitely worth reading that Mike hasn't drawn. But from what I understand, when he works with other people than him to draw it, he handpicks them for what they can do, and I'm not sure if he tailors the stories specifically to artist strengths, kind of like somebody like, say, like Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman would do, so I understand there's probably some effort on that too, but yeah, there is some stuff that is well worth tracking down.
Well, that's an art to it too, is being able to work with somebody and work with their strengths and not force your own self onto it, and that's what it seemed like he's done.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, people refer to it as the Mignolaverse, but he's really built the world to it. And I've had people say, have you ever read BPRD? It's good. Have you ever read the Abe Sapien stuff? It's really
good.
All
that stuff is good. Yeah.
So you basically follow all of it.
You know? I'm a little behind on some things, but yeah, I mean, all that stuff is worth buying. You know?
Wow. Which one was your favorite besides the Hellboy work, I'd imagine? Do you have a particular favorite?
Sentimentally, just because I like that era and that type of character, would probably be Lobster Johnson for me. Just because it's kind of an amalgamation of the different pulp influences, like the Shadow, the Spider, things like that.
Yeah, that stuff's fun. I like the pulp. Earlier in dinner, we were talking about some of the movies, like Sky Captain. And Sky Captain was a movie that came out. It was a movie I was really excited about. A friend of mine kept showing me the trailers and all the extra stuff on it. Well, when she brought it in, it was still at the theater. She brought a bootleg copy. But it was kind of blue-gray. I watched the bootleg. Not so much. I found the DVD somewhere. I thought, well, I'll try it again. It's one of the greatest movies I've ever seen.
I was thoroughly convinced that it was made just for me, just because of all the content it has. And I thought me and my friend Gary were the only two people in the world that actually liked that movie until I was talking online with Mike Kaluta. He said, yeah, I like it. And then I met William Stout at a convention and said he liked it. Okay, good, there's four of us now.
Yeah, it has all the things. It's kind of like more of a modern Dan Dare, you know, non-50s kind of Dare thing.
I mean, it really is a love letter to traditional pulp 30s action hero.
Yeah, I love that stuff. Hey, I'm trying to go down the whole list of it. We were talking about the Shadow movie with Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
I liked it. I watched it on VHS tape, and I remember the beginning of it, and then it just kind of unraveled.
Yeah, I think the best part of the movie is that whole opening bridge scene.
Yeah, that's awesome. I found it on DVD cheap again. I said, I'll give it another whirl. It's kind of fun. I forgot most of the rest of
it. I bought that on Blu-ray, but I've never actually taken it out of the case.
It's one of those things, sometimes you have to be in the right frame of mind. Sometimes you rent a movie and you really want something to happen, but if you have the DVD or Blu-ray, you're just not doing anything. You pop it in, and all of a sudden it's kind of a fun ride. You know?
That's true. You ever run across a movie when you're flipping channels on TV, and no matter where you come into that movie, when you're flipping channels, you just sit there and watch the rest of it.
Oh, yeah. Even if you've seen it a million times.
The Blues Brothers is like that for me. No matter how many times I've seen it, if I'm flipping it, I'm watching the rest of it.
That's one of those movies.
Yeah.
There's a few movies which I've always had a fear my whole life of going to prison. I don't do anything to go to prison, but I don't know. We've all seen Scared Straight in the 70s. They showed on PBS. And I thought, well, I don't want to do that. Not that I ever wanted to go to prison. Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Whenever that comes, when the first time I saw it, a friend of mine kept saying, have you seen Shawshank Redemption? Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was about. No, I was busy.
Right.
It came on TV. I watched the thing. I completely forgot where I was at. And when I finished it, I'm like, oh my God, that was incredible.
Yeah, that is a fantastic movie.
And sure, no matter how many times I've seen it, when that comes on TV, uh-huh. whatever I'm doing, I just stop and watch it.
You know, it's funny, whenever I see that 1 million years BC poster with Raquel Welch, it makes me think of the Shawshank Redemption now.
Yeah. I have a student. He just graduated the University of Miami. And his parents, they're Lithuanian. They came over. And I'll make references when we're working out. And I says, you have to make eye contact. And he'll look away, and I said, look, if you don't make eye contact, look at my chin and my chest. You know, use your peripheral vision. And at one point, I just made a comment. If I was Raquel Welch, you'd be looking there. And then somebody said, Don, he doesn't know who Raquel Welch is. How can you not know who Raquel Welch is? Mm-hmm. Well, it's because his parents grew up in a communist bloc country, and they don't know
how
all the American... Well, he just graduated college. So,
okay, that may be another reason. He's fairly young.
You know, he's young, but a lot of times you learn things from your parents, sure. You know. And so I tried to get him to watch 1 Million BC, one of my favorite movies. Yeah. I know it's not a perfect movie, but, man, I'll tell you, it's
good enough. Yes.
Ray Harryhausen and Raquel Welch in a fur bikini. But he never watched it. He went to college. I found it at Grindhouse Video for $4.
Uh-huh.
He's got it. I gave it to him. He still hasn't watched it. And I said, have you watched the movie? Well, I don't have a DVD player. Find a DVD player. Well, he just graduated college, and he wrote me about he's coming back to class. He says, all right, have you seen 1 Million BC? Are you talking about the one with the dinosaurs and that old lady? Yeah, I watched it. And later I said, what do you think of the soundtrack? Well, the orchestral stuff is good. David, you're obviously lying to me. Watch that movie before you come back. You know, he goes to all the new movies, he goes to all the Marvel movies, and that's fine. He's a movie guy.
Yeah.
One time he was all excited about the remake of Total Recall, why would you remake that movie so soon?
The only reason I watched the remake was to see the vehicle designs and the equipment designs, things like that.
How did you like it?
It was all right.
Yeah.
See, I didn't think it was terrible, and it wasn't great either. It was middle of the road, okay.
I was never... I liked Arnold Schwarzenegger and Conan.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he did other movies, people liked him. I seen them on TV, and they're good movies.
Right.
But I wasn't like an Arnold fan. I was indifferent. Yeah. I still see him as Conan. One time, it was back when cable, you used to have a channel that had the time and the channel guide.
Yeah.
And at the top, they'd always have a preview of some movie. And they showed him running through an airport terminal, and he goes in front of that screen and shows a skeleton when he's going through. And I'm thinking, this is the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Why haven't I watched any of his movies? This is incredible. I couldn't believe how flawless that was.
Yeah.
And then it was Total Recall. Well, my wife and I went to see it at the theater. I could not wait. When it was an adrenaline rush. You know, when it's finished, I mean, it's all people at work talked about.
Yeah.
One of the greatest. Well, I have it on DVD, of course. And when he's talking about, you know, he's interested in a movie, I said, here, let me watch this one. So he watched it, and he brought it back to me. I said, what do you think? Completely deadpan face. It's really clunky.
It's really weird. You know, like, I'll see younger, when I say younger, I'm talking people in their 20s. The Thing is a good example of this.
Yeah.
You know, even though Carpenter's version of The Thing is one of the best remakes that's ever been done, a lot of people don't realize the original, you know, black and white version with James Arness is a really damn good movie.
Yes.
Yeah. You know? And they don't know that. You know?
No, see, the thing, that's something, my mom saw that as a kid, and it scared her to death. And I kept asking her, says, what's that movie? And she said it was a thing. And I was always interested to see it. Well, I never saw it. And then John Carpenter came out.
Right.
Well, I watched part of it, but I don't know, for some reason, watching on cable, it would just kind of disinterest me. I've heard guy on Slow Roller Book, Slow Robot a Go-Go, they talk about it. They love it. That's Mal's favorite movie, I think.
Original version?
No, the new one, John Carpenter.
Okay.
But they do refer back. Al talks about the old James Arness.
Right.
Some of those old movies, there's a charm to it. Like
the absolutely.
The movie itself is really good, but usually the creature at the end looks kind of bad. But the movie, there's a charm.
But sometimes you don't care.
Yeah. Sometimes it turned around where the creatures are great, but the movie and the acting and the story is pretty crummy. Right. I hate to cut the flow, but our battery's almost dead, so we're going to switch to music break.
Save Show Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
Okay, next song was called Colossus. That's by a group called Ogre. They're out of the Portland, Maine area.
Yeah.
And my friend Will Broadbent actually drums for them.
Oh, wow. Is that how you knew of the band?
Yeah.
They're completely new to me. Colossus, you were just talking about.
Yeah, they have, gosh, four albums out now.
Yeah.
But they're, primarily a regional band in the Maine area.
See, I missed that. Used to be everybody had regional bands before they made it big and stuff, and now, I don't know, it's...
Yeah. Well, Will probably grew up on, like comic books and science fiction movies and stuff like we did, so some of their songs have elements of that in it.
Yeah. All heavy metal always seemed that way to me, you know what I mean?
Some of it more so than others.
Right, well...
Kiss, not so much.
Well, see, when I say Kiss, I've seen
even though Gene Simmons is a big science fiction fan.
Yeah, he's a big comic book science fiction guy. You see, Kiss is one of those bands Al and I talk about a lot. I was never a Kiss fan.
Me either.
But if they had bubblegum cards or anything like that, I bought them. I bought the Marvel comic that came out. There's just something fascinating about their look.
Right.
And a lot of guys I went to high school with listened to them all the time, and there's some fun to those albums. You know, I bought magazines just because Kiss was on it. So it's one of those things where I was never a fan buying the albums, but yet at the same time I liked them. So, I don't know, there's a little bit of comic book in some of the things. But anyway, you're talking about Ogre. Do they have CDs available for purchase?
Yeah, you can probably still get physical CDs. I can contact Will and find out how you go about ordering them. I don't know. Yeah, you can probably find some on Amazon, actually.
Right. We'll have a link on the site to it. This is a band I've never heard of.
I think you can get some of your stuff through digital download, too. Right. So,
but you said they have about four albums worth of stuff?
I think so,
That's awesome. You said they were in Japan.
Well, they did a small tour in Japan several years ago. I think it was like three or four dates.
Wow.
Yeah.
So much you don't know.
they're not extremely... I mean, they're not a huge band. I mean,
right. Yeah, there's just so much in the world you never see.
Oh, yeah, tell me about it. You don't have enough time in the day to even look at 5% of all the stuff I'm interested in.
Oh, yeah, it's awesome.
And how do people complain about their board? I don't get that. Unless you're stuck in traffic or waiting in line. I mean, there are literally thousands and thousands of books I've never read, comics, movies... CDs, games.
Sometimes there's a lot of stuff you'd like, but sometimes it's hard to find. A lot of times I've learned from, my friends, people I'm around, I find out, where has this been all my life? Moving somewhere away from where I grew up in, all of a sudden I didn't know anybody that liked the kind of stuff I was, so it was like a void a bit.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I started working at a place and it was surrounded by people like us. And then all of a sudden it's a whole plethora of stuff I never knew existed.
Sometimes just having somebody to talk to you about things you're interested in makes a huge difference.
And then it's a vein. You start hitting veins, and it's music, books, comic books, artwork.
Some people, too, I hate to use this term because it may sound a little derogatory. For their entertainment, they're like filter feeders.
Yeah.
They will grab whatever passes in front of them easily.
Right.
And there are other people that will go out and dig for stuff to find things that they like.
Right.
So,
saying that, I'd put myself in the first category. Earlier, Scott and I were talking about, bootleg albums and stuff like that, which is something Al's talked about on the show before. I was never aware of any of this stuff. Once in a while, I'd meet somebody to tell me something or play something. Where did you find this?
Oh, I never knew bootlegs existed until I got into college. Yeah.
But that's what I mean. Sometimes you find some people... They learn a band they like, and all of a sudden they're really good at finding things most of us will never do.
Right.
Whereas if I couldn't find the record store, it's not going to exist to me,
See, I'm completely opposite. I will dig if it takes me 2 years to find a copy somebody in Japan puts up on eBay, I'll dig for it.
Right. See, I would like to be that kind of way, but if it's not around, I'm not going to find it. If I have a friend that, like you, that finds it, it's okay, can I try it out? Hey, wow, son, where'd you get this? But I'm not one as good at excavating and digging. I'd make a terrible detective. So anyway, So we were just talking about the band Ochre. We're talking about movies. And again, my student does not watch 1 Million BC. I know he hasn't.
You gotta watch that.
Well, you know, I want to say that. You can't. It's a newer generation. I understand that that movie's an old movie from the 60s. It still has a charm to it. I made my daughter watch it with me one time when she was in high school. And she's watching it, and every time one of the dinosaurs would come on, she's, oh, this guy's really good. She was fascinated.
Has she watched the Harryhausen movies?
Yeah, this is the Harryhausen
movie. Right, but I mean, has she watched the other ones?
No, not at the time, no.
Gotcha.
But she was fascinated with the dinosaurs. And then when Raquel Welch showed up, my daughter's like, oh, beautiful. I didn't say anything about Raquel Welch, but my daughter's like,
that's an understatement.
And when she was on Seinfeld at one time, my daughter went, oh, beautiful, every time. So, and then, again, every time the dinosaurs would come on, my daughter was spellbound. And when the movie's finished, she got up and goes, well, that's an hour and a half, I'll never get back.
That's a very backhanded compliment.
Yeah, but, I mean, she watched the movie with me, she liked it. But sometimes there is a clunkiness to it, but to me, I kind of thrive on some of that. You know, I like
one person's clunkiness is another person's charm sometimes.
But, you know, like we were talking about those old 50s movies, the science fiction movies.
Oh, yeah.
The story was good. The acting was good. You know, everything was built up to it. Sometimes
special effects and then maybe not so good.
Yeah,
but
not
you
quite
didn't
up.
Care. You know?
And then it went to the opposite, you know, towards the 80s.
Very much. Yeah, that's very true.
There's a friend of mine I worked with. He did special effects, makeup kind of stuff. And there was a movie they did in the Tampa Bay area called Brainjacked. And it's a horror film, somewhat of a horror film, but it's filmed in our area. And anyway, he invited us to go to the Cinema Draft House, which is in Clearwater. It's one of those places where you can eat and drink and watch
like
a movie.
Alamo Draft House.
Yeah, it's like similar. That. They had a bunch of those in our area, and they all went away but this one. And it was on at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. So I went. My daughter wanted to come. She was in high school, and she brought two of her best friends. It was so much fun. I just went because my friend worked on it. You know, I knew several people there. The movie was fun. I mean, it was really a fun movie. And I really enjoyed myself. Well, when the film was over, we walked out. My daughter was kind of irritated her friends because as soon as we walked out, they just said, that was so bad. And they kept carrying on about it.
Yeah.
I had a blast. Of course, you know, you're with a lot of people and they're excited and stuff. And every time they would zero in, like at one point, the kid was brainjacked. And he wakes up in the morning and he's got this little divot in his forehead like a little scar. And it looked real. It wasn't. And I remember one guy, oh, good job, Mark, to my friend. He was the one that did the makeup on it. So to me, it was nothing but excitement. You know, my friend worked on the film, and, you know, I saw the stuff he did. My daughter liked it. Well, as we left, these girls were carrying on about it. And I said, well, I see what you mean. But I was talking about what I liked about it. And then those two girls were like, well, yeah, actually, I could see the work and what they did. Next thing you know, every time my daughter and I drove by the Cinema Draft House, she would make a fist and scream, brainjacked, you know. And then she kept asking me if I had a copy of it, because that's all her two friends talked about.
Really?
They wanted to watch it again.
Yeah.
So like I said, sometimes it was a good movie. I really enjoyed it. But they, sometimes there's a clunkiness to something that makes it special. You know, when I say that, they set out to do a good job.
Plan 9 is a good example.
Well, and that's where I was going to live. That's why we're doing the show together. one thing my friend talked about was in Brainjack was the acting wasn't always so good.
Sure.
Well, I'm one of those people, I like the characters people play. I couldn't tell you a mediocre actor from a good one. Bad actors I can point out. But Plan 9 from Outer Space is one I wanted to see. Because a friend of mine had that DVD of, what's the guy that did Plan 9 from Outer Space? Ed Wood.
The director?
Yeah.
Ed Wood.
Yeah. Where they put out Ed Wood, Johnny Depp played him.
Oh, yeah. That's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
Walter Landau, fantastic
in
that movie.
I'd
recommend that. Yeah. If anybody out there has never seen the movie Ed Wood, go watch it.
Tell a little bit about Ed Wood to the audience if they don't know.
Ed Wood was a very eccentric director, did really low budget, B grade, semi exploitation, sleaze, science fiction kind of movies. I'm not sure that anything I can come up with that's going to come out of my mouth is going to be a good description of Ed Wood.
See,
it's one of those things you just have to experience or, you know, maybe read up on to understand it.
Planet Nine from Outer Space is a movie I've always heard about. If you ever watched the Seinfeld TV show, there was the Chinese restaurant. They were supposed to go see Planet Nine from Outer Space, never made it.
Right.
And Jerry Seinfeld kept saying, I can't see a bad movie by myself. Who am I going to heckle it with?
Right.
Somebody voted. I've always heard people say it was voted the worst movie ever
made. It's infamous for making all these lists of worst movie ever made, and it's not.
Yeah.
Granted,
it's not at all.
It's not the best movie that's ever been made either, but it's not that bad.
But, you know, the St. Petersburg Times, when Ed Wood, the movie, came out, they did a whole story on Ed Wood.
Right.
And he wasn't a union member in Hollywood. He was doing these films on the fly. It was just showing the Ed Wood movie. And like Scott said, I back him up. It's a good movie to watch. It's a fun movie. Even though Johnny Depp kind of played it cartooning over the top, but it adds to the charm of the film.
Yeah.
But one thing they keep bringing on about was that he was a cross-dresser. And I guess he did a movie about cross-dressing besides all this.
It's called Leonard Glenda.
Oh, is that?
Yeah.
And they focused on that, and they're talking about how he did movies. And when you watch it, at the end of the movie, he realizes Plan 9 is what he's going to be remembered for, according to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you're watching it, it looks like a train wreck. He had Tor Johnson, he had Vampire in it, and I'm thinking, when you're watching it, well, I don't know, but I've always heard of Plan 9, but to me it looked like kind of a neat movie. I like the title.
Bela Lugosi's last movie.
Yeah, Bela Lugosi's last movie.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, my friend had the DVD of Ed Wood. It comes with a copy of Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Gotcha.
So he lent it to me so I could see the movie. I watched Ed Wood on VHS back in the 90s. I'm here to tell you, it's a good movie. And the acting is strong.
I mean,
so when my friend was talking about the Brain Jack and the acting wasn't good, well, I thought it was okay. It's a local movie.
Right.
But you watch it, the movie was set serious. The special effects, not so great. There were some things, but it's a good, fun movie. It's not going to be anything like Creature of the Black Lagoon or any of these movies, but I watched it. Even my friend that lent it to me says, Plan 9 from Outer Space, I've seen some horrifying movies overseas that were in English.
Yes.
And I mean, horrifyingly bad taste, bad movies, bad ideas, bad writing.
Bad everything,
Plan 9 from Outer Space was a fun movie.
It's really fun. Yeah.
And the acting was good. I thought, well, this isn't the
worst
movie.
If you go to it expecting Shakespeare, you're going to be sorely disappointed.
Now, saying that there's dorkiness to it.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah, sure.
But it's
that's part of the charm of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's fun. If it came on TV and you're watching it, you'd start watching things.
Have you ever seen Robot Monster?
No, why? That title sounds familiar
it's
to me.
It's kind of somewhat similar vein in terms of being a really shot for really cheap B-grade science fiction movie. That's another one. If you've never seen Robot Monsters, it's one of those movies you have to see just say, I've seen it.
How did you know about it? How did you know about it?
Probably just reading through magazine articles, actually.
Mm.
You know, you'll have lists of like, 10 best science fiction or whatever genre you may want to put in the 10 best five movies or what have you of a certain decade.
Right.
And then you look at these and you know, have I seen this or have I seen it referenced somewhere?
Right.
Have I seen it maybe in a magazine article or a book or heard other people talk about it? If you have, you do your homework and you look at it and say, okay, that may be worth watching. Track it down and watch it.
Wow. Yeah, have you ever seen Attack of the Killer Tomatoes?
Yes. Poor Timmy, ate him all up.
The first time I ever heard that, there was a TV show in the late 70s called Different Strokes.
Yeah, I remember Different Strokes.
And one of the episodes, I guess they had, I don't know if the guy was a tutor or whatever, but he took those two boys to the movies instead of teaching.
I don't remember that one. Wow.
Yeah, I think they hired him as a teacher for some reason.
Huh.
And he took the two boys and they came back and said, where have you been? And he says, well, we went out. And then the little one, I can't remember his name all of a sudden.
Arnold.
Yeah, Arnold. He says, he took us to see Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. And, of course, the dad got upset about it. And I thought, that's a crazy title. I thought it was just a made-up movie.
No, that ain't what Willis was talking about.
And then I found out it was a real movie. And I was at a convention in 1980, and they played it.
Uh-huh.
And so I sat there and watched it just to say I watched it. It's one of those cult movies. I guess people thought it was fun, but I watched it.
Yeah, it's a really cult movie.
First of all, I saw it. That's horrifying. It's just stupid. Which it's stupid for stupid's sake.
Right.
But I look back on it. You always remember parts. You always think about it. There's a funness to it, and I think sometimes some of the newer movies that came out, they started following that kind of zany idea where anything goes.
It's a formula.
It had the San Diego Chicken and the Stomping.
Oh my God! I forgot about San Diego Chicken. Oh wow. Now I got images of him running through my brain. Yeah.
When I was in the Navy, I was stationed in San Diego. Sometimes you walk around downtown and he'd be running through the city. That's the chicken. Yeah. You know, anyway. He changed the whole sports franchise mascot.
Yes, him and the Philadelphia thing, too.
I love that thing. Yeah. It shoots out confetti and something.
Mascot. It's like Cubert, actually.
Or Cubert looks like him, I guess. Well, here we go. We hit another thing there. So
let me ask you a question. You're talking about cult movies that have a charm, things like that.
Yeah.
We were talking about John Carpenter earlier. Have you ever watched Dark Star?
I've heard of it only.
It's worth watching. It's very, very dark humor.
Yeah.
I mean, its humor is so dark it almost has like a black cloak in front of it.
Right.
But I think that was actually maybe the first movie he did that I think it started off as a student project when he was doing film school at USC.
Yeah.
But that is where Dan O'Bannon, who was a script writer for Alien, worked on Dark Star, did graphics for it. A lot of people don't realize he did graphics for Star Wars,
I didn't know Dan O'Bannon was an artist.
Yeah, he was a graphic artist. He did some of the graphics for Star Wars, like when you're going down the trench and you're seeing the heads-up display and the X-Wing, it's counting down. He did that. He did a few other things for that. So, but I think that's where him and O'Bannon hooked up, and then from there later on, of course, they went to work on Alien with Giger,
Mobius,
Christos, Mobius. There may be somebody else I'm forgetting. Ron Cobb. Yeah.
And he also wrote The Long Tomorrow with Mobius.
Yes, exactly.
And
Total
Recall.
There's a lot of people that knew people that had influences on each other back then,
And Long Tomorrow is where Ridley Scott saw the city that Mobius designed. And then Dan O'Bannon has been everywhere.
Now, did you also know, I think it was in Long Tomorrow, that's actually where they got the probe droid for The Empire Strikes Back?
I never knew that.
Yeah,
I know
it's a tiny little... There are online articles that trace the influences and things like that. Tiny little robot that Mobius drew, and that's where they lifted the design from.
Yeah. That's one thing. Sometimes people say ripoff, but I don't know. It's not like I ever saw any of those. No, but I never saw those movies and looked at that Mobius. Oh, they ripped that off. I mean, they made it their own thing. They got the idea. And even Blade Runner. Mm. When I'd read Long Tomorrow, I read that after I saw Blade Runner.
Right.
Well,
obvious to you when you read it that's where a lot of that came from?
Sometimes you see things and it's a genre, and this is kind of what the newer people are thinking. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm a huge fan of Valerian, and they always point out the things that they got out of Star Wars. I do agree with it, but at the same time, it's not like I read Valerian and look at Star Wars and say, oh, you're a hack. I mean, it's a different thing. They took an idea and made it their own.
Right.
And, but no, Dark Star I've never seen.
Yeah, there's a very fine line between homage and ripoff.
Exactly. Well, and that's one thing I don't like, is when I see some people copy something completely off of it.
Right.
That one I don't go for. But if you can take an idea and make it your own, there's sometimes it goes in a completely different direction than what it starts out with.
And that's how you end up with Sharknado 6.
I work with people. I've never seen those movies, but Sharknado, when it came out, they were so excited. I remember they were so excited they were going to make another one.
I guess it was kind of like probably a modern equivalent of like a Roger Corman movie.
Yeah. You know, we've turned this into a Slow Robot A Go-Go episode. But this has been great.
Well, there is a lot of crossover between movies and comics and stuff.
That's something, again, my friend Mark that worked on Brainjacked, he worked with Herschel Gordon Lewis on what it's called the Uh-Oh Show. I never heard of that, man. And Mark brought in a VHS tape of when he was working on the Uh-Oh Show. And I'm like, this is a local movie? And they were doing it where we live in Florida. And there's all these people walking around with three DVDs holding. And when Herschel Gordon Lewis showed up, they're falling all over themselves wanting to record. Nice man. Right. But he was signing the... Who is this guy? And how has he got these movies? Well, later, Mark lent me, you know, the three movies. Mm-hmm. And I was just being polite. I was going to watch one of them. It was a Sunday. My wife was wanting me to mow the lawn. I watched one movie. I enjoyed it so much, I watched all three of them.
Right.
And then I started watching them with the audio commentary. Mm-hmm. And I thought, again, there's so much stuff in the world you don't know about. Roger Corman was another one. Right. I only knew his name because I'd read about that Fantastic Four movie that they did in, the late 80s or early 90s?
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it never came out. I seen in the magazine. I thought that
another thing I think you probably get, like, bootleg copies of.
Well, that's what Al says. It never came out, but I guess you could always get the bootleg.
Right.
It looked bad, but it actually looked like the Fantastic Four, which is something they've never really done in the movies.
Gotcha.
But I didn't know who Roger Corman was. Well, then I started seeing other stuff with him. There's so many of these directors that got these movies out that, unless they're people in the know,
sure,
you know, filter people like me aren't going to catch it. But I guess you're really familiar with some of these guys.
I mean, some of them, like James Cameron actually got his start working with Roger Corman doing model work.
I didn't know that.
And art, you know, production design. Yeah. Do you remember the movie Battle Beyond the Stars?
Yeah, barely.
Can't think because his first last name's Thomas.
He played John Boy. I remember that movie.
And it's going to drive me crazy until I think of his first name.
Wasn't Robert Vaughn in that movie too?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But Cameron actually did some of the design work and some of the model work on the spaceships in that
movie. I remember when that came out because that was after Star Wars and also space movies were all the rage. And I saw that on TV.
Very cheap Italian.
Yeah. No, saying that, I love some of those.
Some
old
of those
Italian
homages
movies,
and some of them are ripoffs.
Yeah. Yeah. But they were fun. I just remember my freshman year of college, a pre med student, he said, "Yeah, what'd you see?" And it was at Battle Beyond the Stars. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I want to see because I love Star Wars so much." I said, "What'd you think?" I didn't like it.
Well, George Peppard was in it too. Sybil Danning.
Well, yeah. When I say that, it seemed like a dorky movie, but I was at a friend's apartment one time, and it was on TV. And he was like us. He likes that stuff, and he was watching it. Well, I say he wasn't like us. He didn't like comics or anything, but he liked space movies, and that movie was on. And I was sitting there, total jerk. God, this movie's stupid. But yet, I sat there and watched the whole thing with him. That's why I remember Robert Vaughn was in it.
Yeah, he was.
But I didn't know James Cameron worked on that stuff and did the special effects.
Yeah, that was before he was a household name. Yeah.
Right.
Man. Did you know that Adam Savage from Mythbusters worked for ILM before he did any of the Mythbusters stuff?
No.
Yeah, him and Tori Belucci and Grant Imahara, they all worked at the ILM model shop.
No way.
Before they ever did anything with Mythbusters.
Well, honestly, I didn't know that, but I could see that, because he's always building stuff all the time.
Exactly.
He likes that whole culture thing.
He gets paid to do that. I don't get. Yeah. I'm in the wrong line of work here. How do I get paid to do stuff like? I want to be Adam Savage when I grow up.
Well, see, we say that, but at the same time, if I got a job like that, I just see myself crashing and burning. He can do it and keeping the interest to it. You know, that's and Mythbusters. I learned from my daughter. She watched that show religiously.
I love that show.
Yeah, I know. We talk about it. You loved it. And Adam Savage is doing something now, right?
He has a website that's called Tested.
Yeah.
Where he puts up lots of videos on different projects he does. He's a member of a society that's called the Replica Prop Forum.
Right.
Where they build a lot of screen accurate to the nth degree props. I mean, literally, they will track down something as small as a specific type of screw that was used to make it that accurate. There are some hardcore people, but he's heavy. He does all kinds of good stuff.
There was a video of him at a convention. He made a Totoro suit from that animation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought that was incredible. And he's walking around in that hot suit at a convention.
Yeah, he's made all kinds of different suits like that. Like he'll go incognito.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that scores props for me. I thought that was awesome. The video was awesome. Yeah, Adam Savage, you're okay.
Another video, too, if you can ever find it. Neil Gaiman was being interviewed on Minnesota Public Radio.
Yeah.
And he would start telling the story about Adam Savage. they called him on air and got him to sing the Gloria Gaynor song, I Will Survive, in Gollum's voice. Okay. And if you have never listened to that, it is laugh out loud funny.
There's going to be a link on the blog.
It is hysterical.
Scott's going to send me a link, and this will be on the blog, so everybody listening to the show can experience it. You know, Neil Gaiman is one I've never really read too much. Uh-huh. I read some Sandman. Dallas likes it. For the longest time, I didn't understand the hubbub about Neil Gaiman. I mean, when I say this, it wasn't a hate thing.
Right.
I would just read his stories, and I mean, they were good, but I'd read them because I liked the artist. I like Pete Craig Russell. I like Charles Vess. Yeah, well, exactly.
Craig Russell's work on the Ramadan issue, I think, is number 50.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Dallas gave it to me. Now, that would... Craig Russell is one of those artists, if I see him, I buy him.
Yes.
But DC and Vertigo, which I always thought sometimes a mistake, the covers are nice, but they're not done by the artist on the interior sometimes. And issue 50, Craig Russell didn't do the cover.
No, Dave McKean probably did.
Yeah, which is a great artist. But Dallas had the issue. He knew I liked it. He gave it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, why haven't I ever read this before? I love Craig Russell. But then, saying all this, I hear Neil Gaiman on different podcasts.
Uh-huh.
You can't stop listening to him. There's a podcast called The Long Now Foundation. He does talk.
I'm not familiar with that one.
That one, I don't know how I found that.
Uh-huh.
But basically, it was founded by several people, including Brian Eno. And it's about long-term thinking. And podcast is a lecture. So, I mean, it's not the greatest sound quality. Sometimes they go up to 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
But it's a lecture.
Kind of like a TED Talk?
Yeah, something like that. Gotcha. Exactly. That's a good point. But it's teaching people about long-now technology, you know, long-term thinking.
Uh-huh.
And they have different people. And some of these people aren't really good speakers, but, you know, they have reasons.
Right.
And they talk about everything. Food. They talk about, you know, society. They talk about electronics, nanotechnology, stuff I don't know
about.
So
they're talking about futurism, basically.
Exactly.
Oh, I got to find that.
There'll be a link on the blog.
I love that kind of stuff.
And there's a lot of episodes that Brian Eno has done. I think I found it for some reason because of Brian Eno.
Yeah.
They're building a clock. And one thing they're talking about the clock was how society changes over time. Like, if we were going back to Old English, you and I wouldn't know what to say, even though that's the only language I speak.
Right.
And one thing they're talking about was there's a radioactive wasteland out in, you know, somewhere in the deserts of North America, you know, where they tested nuclear stuff, they got it set.
Yeah, probably Alamogordo, I would imagine.
But they had signs that says, warning with a skull and crossbones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they said they're starting to think about what if future generations come, because there's a time lapse for that when it's...
How would they interpret that?
And one thing they're talking about was the skull and crossbones. And they said originally the skull and crossbones was, it wasn't a pirate symbol. It was a Christian symbol. It was two swords crossed with a skull. Now, I'm butchering this whole story. You'll have to go back and listen to some of these episodes. But they started talking about no matter what they put, it could change over time to completely different thing. And I thought, it's always things like that, long-term thinking.
Yeah, I guess the swastika is like that.
What's that?
The swastika.
Yeah.
The traditional use, because you know, there were cultures way before the Nazis that were using that.
Exactly.
You know, American Indians and Indians.
Right. Well, it was a whole
subcontinent, India, and others as well.
A lot of people refer to the swastika as the Hopi migration symbol.
Right.
It's also, I think, an Indian symbol.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told it's a Middle East symbol, but what Hitler did, I think he turned it.
Modified it.
Yeah, he turned it. I think it's supposed to be square, and he had an angle. When I was in the Navy, we pulled into Sri Lanka. The ship was too big to pull in, so what they do is they bring in small boats, you know, launches, and bring us in.
Right.
It was a wet day. It was cold. We're all in this little boat pulling in. We were out in the Indian Ocean for 3 months, and there's all these tankers. And sometimes you have these, you know, guys from other countries in a tanker yelling at us, you know, because the sailors are pulling, they're teasing us.
Yeah.
And then we pull in, and there's this one tanker there, and it has the swastika, and it's made out of steel girders. It's painted orange in the circle on the right at the bow of the ship. And some were officers on the boat, and I looked, what is that? And it's like all the air sucked out of the atmosphere. Right. It froze your soul.
Yeah.
And if somebody told me that's not the swastika, it's not at an angle, and it's not backwards. And they were saying that that's an Indian symbol. Right. It wasn't a German ship.
It just goes to show you context is everything.
And the power of the thing. But Hitler was really big into symbology and stuff like that, and graphics. Mm-hmm. But it's
propaganda. I think it's, God, the propaganda posters from World War II.
Yeah.
Not only from Germany, but from Russia.
Right.
Some of that stuff has some amazing artwork.
Yeah, it is fantastic. It is fantastic. I know Howard Chaykin was a big fan of some of that stuff that he put into his work.
A lot of it's kind of an Art Deco kind of a style.
Right. Yeah. It's strong work. But anyway, the swastika, I also know it's a Hindu symbol. Mm-hmm. It's like I said, it's from a lot of different places. How did we get on the swastika?
I have no idea.
Oh,
we're
it's because
of
the Long Now Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Neil Gaiman was on one of those, and he spoke.
Mm-hmm.
I can't stop listening to the man. I've heard him on the New York Public Library podcast, mm-hmm. which is excellent. When I'm telling you these podcasts, please keep listening to us when you find these better ones. But I found him one of the most interesting people I've ever seen. And since then, I have read some stories he's written that I see what he's talking about and everybody loves.
Neil's fun to listen to because he's got that great brain.
Yeah.
He's a giant receptacle of all this knowledge. But he also has a really, really good speaking voice. And that combination is hard to beat.
But what he says sometimes is very insightful and very interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of times it's thinking that I've never thought about.
Right.
You know, yeah, he's something else. How did we start talking about Neil Gaiman?
I'm losing through P. Craig Russell, I think.
P. Craig Russell.
We're talking about the Ramadan issue.
That's it, the Ramadan issue. So anyway.
But yeah, that issue and the two that Charles Vest did, that is some really, really fine work.
Well, you know, people, I see, especially young women, I see in comic shops buying Sandman. And a lot of the Vertigo titles at the time, which I've started reading. Because of you, I started reading Starman by James Robinson. I never read those. That's turned into one of my favorite comics.
Really?
I'm finding back issues.
Yeah.
I bought three trades. I think James Robinson's probably one of my favorite writers now. I've read other stuff.
I haven't read a lot of the newer stuff he's done in the past few years. But, you know, he's a really good writer.
I find him and I think, man, this guy, he's got a... He can write with a modern sensibility, but he can put all that Silver Age stuff that, you know, I...
Yeah, did you read the Golden Age series that he did? I think it's just called The Golden Age.
I've never
read
it.
That's good, too.
Yeah, but he can put that stuff in, which when we talk about some of the stuff, it could be kind of old-fashioned and dorky. He can put in the modern stuff. And
same thing with Darwin Cook.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Very similar.
He could put that in with a modern sensibility, but not modify and changing. You know, some people will take old stuff and try to square, you know, round hole, square peg in a round hole and change it to their thinking.
Yeah.
Some artists, you know, and writers can take that old stuff and put it into a modern thing, and it didn't lose the fantastic, you know. Absolutely.
That's one of the things I think they did a really good job of when they did Batman the Animated Series, when they made that quote-unquote dark deco style.
Right.
You know, where you had modern inventions, say like a cell phone, along with blimps flying around. And it works great.
And they put it like it was in the 40s, but it was the modern world. Yes, that's
just getting the right people on the right project.
That was that's absolutely my favorite series.
Yep.
And that's to me the definitive Batman. I've got all the DVDs.
No
matter how many times I watch it, I watch
when
it.
When I look
over
up Batman in the dictionary, it says see Kevin Conroy.
That's one thing. I get tired of like Don Bluth movies. They always say with the voice talents of, and they get you know big name stars. Well.
Sure.
I don't mind if they get good actors to play it, but I'm not watching it because the celebrity's doing the voice.
Right.
But when Batman the Animated Series, I saw it in the Comics Buyer's Guide. Remember that?
Absolutely. I used to, God, that was like one of my highlights of the week, was getting that in the mail. We're going to go off on another tangent.
That's fine.
Every single week, if for you guys that didn't know what it was, this was back in the 80s up through the 90s, weekly newspaper format.
Yeah.
It was usually folded into two sections.
Right.
And comics never had two friends that were better than Don and Maggie Thompson.
Exactly.
I learned so much from the essays that they wrote, things they promoted. It, they really changed the way I look at things.
Well, and they brought a whole, and Al talks about this. That's where you could find other comic collectors. Right. You could find other comics you couldn't get. Yeah, they completely. I apologize. This is greatness, but the battery's coming low again. I changed them, but I guess they're old. This has been a fantastic episode. It's been great to actually meet Scott face to face. It's been great to have you on here. One thing I want to say, I can't say enough about Virginia. Virginia, you're beautiful. The people are fantastic. It's nothing but a state of kind people that I've met so far, and that's saying something.
And
so,
it's better when it's not so humid.
Yeah. Well, it's we've had some pretty harsh weather lately, but it's Virginia, I love you. I'll be back again. Anyway, anything you want to say before we go, Scott?
I have no idea.
Okay. I kind of strong-armed Scott to come on here, but he said, I don't have anything to say. He said, well, Al and I don't either, so we'll just wing it. Anyway.
We need more comics.
There you go. Listen to this man, and we'll see you on the other side.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!